This is Herb Montgomery with Renewed Heart Ministries, and I welcome you to this week's weekly podcast. Our feature text this week is John 8, 2 through 3, where it says, "At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts, where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery." This week, I want to address a story that I think most of us have only heard either conventional explanations or traditional expoundings of. And in my opinion, how this story is typically spoken of normally, it doesn't do much. It does little more than allowing us to continue in our culturally conditioned lives, basically unchanged from the way we were even before we heard the story. The story is often used today, and there are some exceptions, but it's used by one of two groups. It's used by behaviorists who say that, yes, Jesus forgave, but he also said, go and sin no more. And in this use, this story serves really no more than to confirm them in their already set in motion behaviorism. And the story is also used by those who have been deeply wounded by behaviorists as a treatise on how behaviorists are to not judge, reminding them that Jesus also said, he who is without sin first cast the first stone. And on this side too, this story serves little more than to simply confirm where the anti-judgmentalists were already at. And I want to suggest this week that if these are our only two options in our search for understanding this story, then we miss the entire underlying point of the story completely. Something much deeper is going on in this story that we just don't see on the surface. And this something deeper is what all of us, I think both behaviorists as well as the anti-judgmentalists alike, may be trying to avoid with our surface explanations, even unknowingly, because we fear what the deeper narrative we fear that it could implicate all of us. But what I want to talk to you about first this week is scapegoating. This story isn't really about anti-judgmentalism, nor is it really about loving the sinner but hating the sin. Instead, it's about scapegoating. Now, Rene Girard, who some regard today as a veritable Einstein of sociology and theology, in his work on violence and the sacred, he discovered that societies in times of crisis throughout human history, time and time again, they are reunited by unifying around hatred for a common enemy. And this is this enemy is selected as, number one, different from us. It's a them versus a us. Number two, it's usually a minority whose absence would least affect the overall society. And number three, the common enemy are those who the rest of society blame for society's problems. These are a people or a person that the blame for society's problems can be placed on and whose presence must now be removed from the society. And various methods can be used to do this. Some are political, some are economic, some are religious. But regardless of the method, the attempt is to characterize the minority as an enemy to the well-being of society. And they must be vilified. Scapegoating doesn't work if it doesn't work to unify a society if that minority is seen as being victimized instead. Those being scapegoated, they must be villains or of moral disrepute. They must not be seen as victims, but instead they must be seen as enemies of what is just and what is good, and therefore they have to be opposed. And society, these societies in this scenario, they now possess a common enemy, and the unity within which that society was being threatened is now restored as they rally together around this new common enemy. You can see a great example of this in Luke 23, verse 12. I want to encourage you to look that up. What led Girard to become a Christian is his discovery that the Jesus of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John was uniquely different. This Jesus uniquely sought to expose human society's scapegoating mechanisms. He sought to create a human community that was centered on love for our enemies, removing the exclusive lines of us and them instead of hatred for a common enemy. And finally, this Jesus becomes the ultimate scapegoat in the story, politically, economically, and religiously within the narrative. And in contrast to the narratives of human history, Jesus does this through an unjust death, an unjust execution, and then a resurrection that puts an end once and for all to our practice of sacrificing scapegoats. And this profoundly affected René Girard. And it's not only seen simply in Jesus' death and resurrection. Jesus actually spent his entire life pulling back the layers underneath which we hide this morally monstrous ugliness of humanity's continual sacrifice of innocent victims for the protection or the advancement or the well-being of the much larger population. René Girard writes in the Girard, this is from the Girard Reader, which if you're new to René Girard and you'd like a kind of a primer, kind of a crash course in what Girard's thinking and his sociology is, his theories. I want to recommend the Girard Reader. The Girard Reader basically takes excerpts from many of his books, and then so you get an overall view of what Girard taught, and then you can go back to the different sources. If one of those sections catches your attention, you can go back to the book from which that's taken and pursue that further. But this is from the Girard Reader. René Girard writes, "The Gospels not only disclose the hidden scapegoat mechanism of human cultures, but witness to the God who stands with the innocent victim and is revealed through him." That is a powerful statement. In his book, I See Satan Fall Like Lightning, René says, "The most important of these we find in the Gospel of Luke. The famous prayer of Jesus during the crucifixion, 'Father, forgive them, because they don't know what they are doing.' Persecutors think they are doing good, the right thing. They believe they are working for justice and for truth. They believe they are saving their community." Jesus called this actually in the Gospels the way of sacrifice rather than the way of mercy. It was to open our eyes and to call us away from the way of sacrifice to the way of mercy that Jesus really sets all of his energy in his teachings, his death and resurrection. And this is where we pick up our story in John chapter 8. The story in John 8 is really where Jesus stops a lynching. The teachers of the Torah, along with the Pharisees, they're feeling threatened by Jesus, and their place within society is at risk, and they have to remove this threat and be thinking about Cain and Abel at this moment. But in order for it not to backfire, Jesus must not be seen as an innocent victim. The sacrifice of Jesus has to be justifiable. Jesus has to be seen as a sinner and someone who is disregarding the law of Moses. So they lay this trap, and a woman is caught in the very act of adultery. And what I find most appalling about adultery in the first century is adultery laws didn't apply to men unless the woman they were having an extramarital affair with was also married. The adultery laws of the Torah applied to both the man and the woman only if the woman involved was married. The culture was patriarchal, and the chief concern expressed in the underlying moral logic of the law was protecting the property rights of the man to whom the woman involved in the adultery belonged. And we're not given the details of how this tragic mistake was made by this woman in this story. We're not told if she was lured by some pretense into this or if this was rape, but either was possible within the patriarchal environment of first century Palestine. And obviously, it was a trap set for Jesus, however this woman came to be there, but she is now the chief expendable pawn in their scheme. And the trap was then set. They asked Jesus, "In the law, Moses commands us to stone such a woman. Now, what do you say?" And this is where the story gets interesting. At this point, the story takes an unexpected turn, and Jesus bends down and begins writing on the ground. And I've heard and I have read so many try just one convoluted attempt after another to show what Jesus actually was writing on the ground that day. And all of these attempts are best guesses at best. But my favorite one, if we're going to talk about those, is actually Shane Claiborne's, where he he suggests that maybe what Jesus was writing on the ground is, if this doesn't work, run, woman. And I think that's hilarious. Claiming to know what Jesus wrote that day, I think, is to miss the point. To get caught up in trying to figure out, though, what Jesus wrote is the point itself. And let me explain what I mean by that. Jesus has to get their attention off of being centered on this woman. He has to draw all the attention to himself. He comes alongside this woman and draws the attention of everyone away from her to him. And you see, scapegoating only works if the scapegoat, and in this case it's the woman, is the center around which everyone else can unite. And Jesus begins disrupting this mechanism by doing something brilliant. He bends down and begins writing mysteriously, drawing the attention of everyone there away from this woman to himself. And he slowly trades places with her, placing himself now at the center of their attention, as each of them, one by one, begins to look down and try to see what Jesus is writing. And we can't miss this. Jesus begins by slowly drawing their attention away from her to him. And if John had wanted us to know what Jesus wrote that day, he would have told us. It would be there in the Jesus story. But John purposefully leaves the words out for a dramatic reason. John, in this beautiful form, he preserves this action in the manner in which he records the story for future readers as well. By leaving what Jesus wrote unrecorded, your attention, even right now as you read this, if you can be self-aware for just a moment, is on trying to figure out what Jesus wrote rather than focusing on the woman. And Jesus that day, in the beautiful way that John has preserved this story for us, he comes alongside the woman and draws even our attention off of her onto himself. And you'll notice during this whole thing, you weren't thinking about the woman at all until I mentioned her again. You were trying desperately, especially if you're OCD like me, to figure out instead, what is Jesus writing? But we can't focus on both. We can only focus on one or the other, and Jesus knows this. And next, Jesus takes a chance. And remember, this could have gone either way very quickly. It could have gone south very quick. They could have chosen to stone both Jesus and the woman. She is an adulteress and Jesus as a blasphemer. But Jesus took the risk, and he stood in solidarity with this woman who's being sacrificed, who's being scapegoated, in reality being victimized. And with one contemplative statement to the oppressors, which was the, "You who are without sin, cast the first stone," he not only saves this woman from what's about to happen, he also won what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. called a double victory. Jesus not only saves the woman, but he saves the perpetrators too of this act, this violence. Jesus saw here two sets of victims that were present. He saw the woman and he saw their accusers. He looked at both of them as victims. There's two parties who were held captive to whatever you want to label it, whether it's systemic injustice, systemic scapegoating, systemic violence, systemic sacrifice rather than mercy. The point is that Jesus saved both. Scapegoating or sacrifice is the way of the Satan. It's the way of the accuser. Mercy is the way of God. And the God we see in Jesus, Jesus interrupts the proceedings of the path of the accuser, and he sets the entire group on the path of God. And this story calls us to look at scapegoating from the perspective of the victim and of Jesus. And the story ends in redemption rather than victimization. It ends in mercy rather than sacrifice. And I also want to talk about this phrase, go and sin no more. This is probably the most misunderstood statement by Jesus in the entire story. The word for sin here that John uses is hamartano, which is the verb form of the noun hamartia. In the ancient Greek world, hamartia was the term that Aristotle uses in poetics. And one of the ancient Greek story genres was tragedy. And in a tragedy, in a story that's classified as tragedy, a mistake, it's not a lifestyle, it's a mistake or an error in judgment that's made by the main character. It's called the hero's tragic flaw. And this error in judgment is what leads the hero or the heroine to a tragic downfall. This definition, I think, fits extremely well with our story here, because if it wasn't for Jesus, this story would have been classified as a tragedy with the woman being the central character. Now, but I don't want you to misunderstand what I'm saying. Hamartia can refer specifically to the tragic mistake itself. But I don't want you to miss this. Mounce's complete expository dictionary of Old New Testament words states that hamartia can also refer to the guilt of the wrongdoing as well as the wrongdoing itself. Hamartia can go way beyond the behavioral aspects of an action to the guilt that's associated with that action as well. In these next passages, John's use of hamartia, which is, it's very unique to the way that other authors of the New Testament use hamartia. John's not talking about a behavior, but guilt for a behavior. Not the committing of a wrongdoing itself, but the guilt for committing the wrongdoing. And this distinction is important if we're going to see how it ties back into our story in John 8. All of these examples that I'm about to give you are from John, who is the only gospel writer to use the phrase, go and sin no more. This first one is John 9, 2 through 3. His disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? This is John 9, 2 through 3. It would make no sense to look at hamartia from John's use of it here as purely behavior in this passage. How could this man have committed hamartia as a behavior before he was even born? But if we take Mounce's definition of the word as also being able to refer not just to a behavior, but guilt for a behavior as well, not merely committing it, but guilt over committing it, the text makes more sense. The apostles are asking, in John's way of using hamartia, they're asking, Rabbi, who is guilty of sin, this man or his parents, since he was born blind? And these passages are from John as well, these next one. The first one is 1 John 3, verse 9, where John says, those who have been born of God do not sin because God's seed abides in him. They cannot sin because they have been born of God. 1 John 5, 18, we know that those who are born of God do not sin. That's a harsh statement. I'll come back to it in a minute. 1 John 3, 6, no one who abides in him sins. No one who sins has either seen him or known him. In 1 John 3, 9, John says cannot sin. Stop and think about that. If you're born of God, you don't sin? Really? You can't sin? Paul would never have said that followers of Jesus are incapable of hamartia. Yet Paul uses hamartia, remember, behaviorally. John goes much deeper, and he's using hamartia to refer not just to behaviors or choices, but the guilt that's associated with certain behaviors. And I've seen this verse cause so much heartache and really damage when hamartia, here used by John, is defined behaviorally rather than as guilt over one's behavior. I've seen it rob a ton of people of any assurance. Every time they make a mistake, they wonder if they were ever really genuinely born again at all. Because those who are born of God don't sin, and they sinned, and so were they really born again? On the other side of the spectrum, I've seen gross sins being perpetrated against others, while those committing such actions, actually, they've said to me, well, this can't be sin, because I've been born again. And John says that if you abide in Jesus, you can't sin. Is John saying that if you abide in Jesus, you no longer make moral mistakes? Not only that you don't, but that you can't. Is John really teaching here that when you choose to follow Jesus, you achieve overnight undefeatable moral perfection? These verses are dangerous if you interpret them as meaning that a Jesus follower cannot ever sin again. But if what John is saying is that once you're born of God, that the accuser loses his ability to entrap you with overwhelming feelings of guilt over your sins, then this passage from John actually becomes blessed good news of freedom from guilt, shame, and stigma, being stigmatized or the stigma or the condemnation of our behaviors. John uses hamartia, and remember, John's use again is unique in the New Testament. John it goes way beyond the behavior of sinning. John is saying in all of these passages that if you're born of God, if you know him, if you've come to see him as he really is, you are no longer enslaved by feelings of guilt over your behavior, and you can't be. If God looks like Jesus, then guilt loses its power over us to control our futures. And to the degree that we believe that God looks like Jesus, to the same degree, we'll be set free from guilt, from shame, and stigma over our mistakes. And Paul actually says the exact same thing in Romans 8, verse 1. He says that there is therefore no more condemnation to those who are in Christ. Now let's return to our story in John 8. Remember in John 8, 9 through 11, it says, Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus straightened up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, sir." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way, and from this point forward, sin no more." And here's the million-dollar question. Is Jesus siding with the accusers now and implying that the woman really is to blame for all that took place that day? Is Jesus saying, "Yes, I don't condemn you, but they're right. Don't do this anymore"? Having escaped barely with her life, do we even think that she would need to be told not to do this again? Or on another note, is Jesus telling her to never sin again? Is he setting her up for questioning her sincerity as a Jesus follower every time she fails from that day forward? Is Jesus really expecting this woman to never sin again from this point forward, this initial point forward? And I don't want to be misunderstood. I believe with all my heart that Jesus does change, radically change, the direction of our lives when we meet him. But which of us, after meeting Jesus the very first time, sinned no more? Which of us never sinned again? And again, the direction of our life dramatically changes when we meet Jesus. But haven't we all still made moral mistakes here and there from time to time after our first encounter with Jesus? Following Jesus, I think, is much more like learning how to walk. Following Jesus is an adventure and learning how to live a radically different life. But it's a learning process. And none of us become Olympic gold medalists in our behavior after our first encounter with Jesus like this woman. Which of us achieved overnight sin no more moral perfection after meeting Jesus the very first time? What John is showing us here is that Jesus is saying something to this woman that is much, much deeper. Jesus is saying, "Go and be guilty of this tragic mistake no more." Certainly, her life direction was changed that day, but Jesus wasn't siding with her accusers here, and he wasn't setting her up for continually doubting her own sincerity either. He was setting her free from the guilt and the shame and the stigma of what she had been involved with that day. Jesus was saying, "Woman, from this point forward, go forth and be guilty of this mistake." Remember, that's John's use of hamartia. Be guilty of this mistake no more. You are free. I don't condemn you, and I don't want you to condemn yourself. Don't define yourself by this mistake this day. Go and be guilty of this tragic failure no more. You don't have to define yourself the way that these people have defined you here today. You're not what they call a sinner. You're a daughter of Abraham too. And you can cross-reference that with what Jesus said to Zacchaeus in Luke 19:9. Jesus looks at this woman and he gives her a fresh start. What he says is what he's really saying, according to John. If you understand his use of the word hamartia, which we translate as sin, Jesus is saying, "Go and be guilty of this sin no more." And far from looking at this story through the lens of behaviorism or anti-judgmentalism, this is a story that contrasts the way of sacrifice with the way of mercy, the way of scapegoating with the way of redemption. We see Jesus coming alongside this woman about to be scapegoated or stoned, and by his own religious community even. And Jesus turns the tables on us all and calls all of us to two new realities. Number one, Jesus calls us to, if we have been religiously scapegoated in the past, he calls us to no longer define ourselves according to the moral inferiority of how the majority has made us feel. And number two, if you've taken part in religiously scapegoating others, it's time to humbly submit to Jesus' radically different way of looking at those we are presently rallying together against, calling them sinners, and using the Torah once again as our justification. And this is what converted the early apostles, especially the apostle Paul. When Paul was on the road to Damascus, and he heard that Jesus was on the side of those he was persecuting, it was a life-changing moment for him. It's what converts each of us. It's at least one of the central points of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. And it could be debated whether or not it's the central point itself. Jesus has revealed that God, he's given us a revelation of God as being with those whom we are politically, economically, or religiously scapegoating. And we have to come to terms with the reality that we are with God when we too are with them. And the Jesus story calls us to recognize where we are participating in the ways of sacrifice rather than mercy, the way of scapegoating minorities for the certitude of the greater populace. It calls us away from arranging our lives where a common enemy is always needed. And it beckons to us from this point forward to stand in solidarity with those we once scapegoated. Jesus calls us to abandon whatever sacrificial system we've stood in solidarity with up to this point, and to now stand in solidarity with those who are being victimized by those systems instead. We're to be like Jesus, coming alongside those who are about to be stoned, saying, if you're going to stone them, then you're going to have to stone me too. But know this, whoever among you is truly innocent in all of this, let them cast the first stone. As followers of Jesus, we follow Jesus into the hope of a new world where the continual tides of sacrifice can be turned and waves of mercy rather than sacrifice can wash over our human societies as the waters cover the sea, according to Isaiah. The heart group application this week, actually it's more of a confession than it is an application. I've been asking you to sit with Jesus over the past few weeks, asking him to show you a people group that is on his heart. And the reason I've asked you to do this is because this is what he has inescapably done to me. And for me, this is really where the rubber meets the road. If the story of the resurrection teaches us anything, it teaches us that the way of sacrificial systems that justify scapegoating innocent victims has come to an end. The resurrection puts on display that the presence of God is no longer to be sought within the most exclusive, most holy places belonging to those systems. The true dwelling place of God is now to be found in the ones shamefully suspended on crosses at the demand of those religious sacrificial systems. The resurrection is the start of a whole new world, and it means we don't need to fear the consequences of our nonviolent engagement with those systems either. We stand in the victory of the Christ over all injustice, a victory that we believe has already been won. And so here goes my confession. I've taken a lot of heat over what I'm about to say here over the past few months. I've even had a few of my meetings cancel over this, and I've had those who have been my friends for years, who now shun me as I begin to take my place alongside those that I believe are being scapegoated today. Rather than pursuing dialogue and discussion, I've simply just been written off. But there's a beauty in the pain of rejection when you're now standing alongside those you yourself used to reject. And being on the receiving end myself now of religious scapegoating, it's my prayer that Jesus will use it deep inside of me to change me first and foremost. And here are the responses I've gotten so far. Some people say, but I cannot endorse their choice of lifestyle. Justin Lee's continued passion to define the terms that we're using, I think, is so needed in all of these discussions. Justin asks the question, would you agree with me that sex outside of marriage is wrong? And his audience responds, yes. Then Justin continues, then would you also agree that heterosexuality before marriage is also wrong? And the audience at this point just sits there scratching their heads. Heterosexuality is not about whom one has sex with. It's about whom one feels attracted to. And we don't choose who we're attracted to. We just are. Attraction is not something one chooses. It's what someone experiences, whether they want those attractions or not. In the same way, homosexuality. It can't be reduced to a sexual act. Homosexuality is defined as feelings of attraction, whether those feelings are wanted or not, to the same gender. And I don't know one of my gay or lesbian friends who chose to feel attracted to their same gender. For them, this is not a lifestyle that they chose. It's something they experience inside of them that they can't find an explanation for. It would be so helpful if we would stop referring to homosexuality as a choice of lifestyle. Just as with heterosexuality, there are expressions of sexuality, both hetero and homo, that are very unhealthy. But it is unjust to group all homosexuals under one sweeping characterization, or heterosexuals for that matter. The struggle for my Christian LGBTQ friends is to find the difference between what is a healthy expression of these same gender attractions that they're feeling, whether they want to or not, and what's an unhealthy expression of these same gender attractions. And trust me, there is just as much debate on this subject among them as there is among my straight friends. Yet my friends in the LGBTQ community, they're left to struggle with this alone, being shut out from the support of their Christian communities for even having these unchosen attractions to begin with. And I have to humbly confess that I think we are completely missing the point of the Jesus story here. We claim that this story is the center of all that we're about. Yet this story is about a Jesus who met scapegoating in his own religious community head on, and it cost him his life to do so. This is the story of a Jesus who encountered those who were being labeled as a sinner according to the Torah. They were being marginalized, and in John 8, even lynched by the religious community of Jesus' day. And this is the story of how Jesus loved these people, how he stood in solidarity with them, and having called them his own, these who were being marginalized his own, he stood in solidarity with them all the way to the end. And as Gerard said, those who scapegoat others, they think they're doing good. They think they're doing the right thing, that they believe they're working for justice and truth, and they believe they're saving their community. And Jesus prayed they don't know what they're really doing. Scapegoating in the Jesus story appears in the form of giving a greater value to a definition of Torah observance, even if they have to sacrifice a few among their community for that observance. It's giving greater value to their definition of Torah observance over and above the value of those who are being sacrificed. Scapegoating always picks on an individual or a group, which is a minority, whose absence would least diminish the overall whole. And their absence really won't cost us a thing. Scapegoating then finds a justifiable reason for us to unite together in sacrificing them. Scapegoating in the Jesus story also possessed an air of holiness. It was a kind of holiness, though, that caused those who were being sacrificed to steer clear and to keep their distance. Jesus, on the other hand, stood in solidarity with those who were being sacrificed. He valued people and the way of mercy over and above the way of sacrifice, even when the way of sacrifice was endorsed by the Torah. Jesus possessed a kind of holiness, and we can't forget this, that actually attracted those whom the religious culture of his day, with the Torah in their hands, were scapegoating. And some have said, but the Bible clearly condemns homosexuality. Whether or not the Bible addresses same-gender attraction at all, or what exactly was the moral logic that undergirds the biblical statements concerning same-gender sexual acts, these are topics that are hotly debated among scholars today, and for evidence of this, see The Bible, Gender, and Sexuality by James V. Brownson. And although I believe that we need more discussion about these topics, given the onslaught of such massive misinformation that's being promoted, to stop here, though, I think also misses the point of the Jesus story. Even if one does deem the act of same-gender sex, not homosexuality, but not same-gender attraction, but same-gender sex, the action, as condemned by the Bible, A grave reality is staring back at us in the face. Why are the reactions of those within the LGBTQ community so governed by our amygdala rather than Jesus? And for those who don't know what the amygdala does, that's the organ inside of us that is responsible for our reptilian responses of fight or flight. And why are my friends in the LGBT community not being strangely attracted to us as they were to Jesus? We may be claiming to follow Jesus, but then why are our results almost identical to the results of those who were doing the scapegoating in the Jesus story? Why are our results so similar to those who actually crucified Jesus too? Why do we find ourselves getting caught up senselessly with the crowd, crying, "Crucify them and anyone who stands with them"? We have to let all of these contradictions confront us. Deeming same-gender sex as contrary to the Bible may make us feel more secure as biblicists, but it gets us nowhere as followers of Jesus. We still have to confront the life of Jesus and how he taught us to relate to those whom any religious community in our day deems as living contrary to their sacred text. And we have to be suspicious of any activity that blanket labels a minority as sinners and then unites to rally against them. Scapegoaters, remember, never realize they are actually scapegoating until it's too late. And we see this in Acts 2, verse 37. And we have to let the Jesus story confront us if we're going to claim that this story is central to what we're about. Some have said, "Okay, Herb, but Jesus said, 'Love the sinner, hate the sin.'" And actually, Jesus never said that. What he actually said was that we're to get the log out of our own eye before we can even hope to help others as they are trying to see through the dust that's in their own. Until someone feels that we truly are their brother, their sister, their friend, until we've stopped and actually listened to their stories, it's not that we don't have the right to speak into their lives, which we don't. It's that we don't even have the ability to. Without first entering into relationship with those from the LGBT community, without entering into their struggles and their stories, and until we stop talking about them and we start listening to them and alongside with them, even when we mean no harm and our intentions are pure, we will continue to do damage that we don't even realize that we're doing. And here in West Virginia, we used to use canaries in the coal mines to warn the coal miners when the air had become toxic. When the canary died, it was time for the coal miners to run to the surface for purer air. Walter Brueggemann, who's the world's foremost Old Testament scholar, he has gone on record saying that those from the LGBT community, they are the canaries in our religious coal mines today. And the way we as Christians have historically treated even Christian young people who begin experiencing same-gender attraction, it's created an 8 times higher rate of suicide among them than any other category of Christian or LGBTQ youth. This screams to us today, and we have to pay attention to it, that in all of our piety and all of our holiness, that we have to be open to the possibility that we might have imbibed more the spirit of scapegoating than we have the spirit of Christ. Seeing this only as a matter of whether this is sin or not grossly misses the point entirely. If sin is supposed to produce death, then how we're relating to those involved in this is producing death. We have to ask, where is the greater death producing sin in actuality? Where is the greater sin? Is it in an orientation that we're so afraid of? Or is it in the way that we're relating to those who possess this orientation, regardless of how they got it? First, we have to get the log of scapegoating out of our own eyes, and only then will we be able to see clearly enough to be a source of life and a source of hope and mercy and redemption rather than death and greater damage as we try and fix them. The percentage of people who have been irreparably damaged by reorientation therapy is significantly greater than any percentage of those who, by their own admission, say they now live lives that on the outside match the lives of straight people, even though they're still experiencing same-gender attraction on the inside. And for the sake of every young person who is struggling with this as I'm speaking right now in this podcast, for the sake of every phone call that I will receive in the middle of the night to talk someone back down off the ledge, it's time for change. If we're following Jesus, why is our story so different than his? And I wonder at times if this is why Jesus was crucified by the teachers of the Torah in his day. Was it because he chose to stand in solidarity with those who were being scapegoated around him too? Stanley Hauerwas, for me, has summed up what may be the underlying basis of our scapegoating of the LGBT community today. And notice that the part that I'm going to emphasize, Hauerwas writes, as a society, we have no general agreement about what constitutes marriage and or what goods marriage ought to serve. We allegedly live in a monogamous culture, but we are at best, in fact, serial polygamists. We are confused about sex, why and with whom we have it, and about our reasons for having children. This moral confusion leads to a need for the illusion of certainty. If nothing is wrong with homosexuality, then it seems everything is up for grabs. Of course, everything is already up for grabs. But the condemnation of gays hides that fact from our lives. So the moral no to gays becomes the necessary symbolic commitment to show that we really do still believe in something. If this isn't scapegoating, which is defined as gaining security or certitude or unity about our own moral okayness by the way we justify treating a minority, then I have to confess this week, I'm really at a loss to know what scapegoating even is. And I know we feel as if we're simply standing up for what is right. And remember, those who unknowingly are caught up in a wave of scapegoating always do. But it's really not much different than a modern-day lynching, even though we do it socially instead of physically. Jesus stood in solidarity with and he defended those who were being damaged by those who were standing up for what is right in his day. And the servant is not greater than the master. I know this will be misunderstood by many, and I'll be accused of throwing out the Bible, as well as other accusations. But I'm actually taking the Bible seriously. I'm leaning into the narratives of the scriptures, not further away from them. I'm taking a hard look at what the central story of our scriptures, which is the Jesus story, is really saying, and I'm making the decision to stand in solidarity with my Christian LGBTQ brothers, sisters, and friends. What identifies us, what defines us, what binds me to them, is our mutual love for Jesus and our desire together to follow him, not which gender we find ourselves attracted to. Granted, that discussion is always going to be on the table, and that's just because of the culture wars that are always circling right above our heads. But like so many other Christians today, I'm done with the culture war. I've got to follow Jesus instead. I know I may lose support because I'm standing up for them, whom I'm calling now my brothers and my sisters and my friends, especially the younger ones in the LGBT community. And honestly, losing support, that part, has caused me to lose more sleep than I've gotten over the past few months. I'm banking on the hope that somehow God will continue to provide and there will be more manna tomorrow for my family. But I cannot in good conscience remain silent any longer about the abuse that I've watched my friends endure at the hands of those who carry the name Christian. Brian Zahn recently wrote, "You can't unknow what you now know and still be true to yourself." Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. also said that cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but because conscience tells one it is right. King also went on to say that in the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. And I can't stay silent anymore. I'm praying that God helps me through this, but the servant is not greater than the master. If you would like to further contemplate how, as a Jesus follower, we can learn to relate to those within the LGBTQ community without throwing away our Bibles, the following resources are my top recommendations that I think will aid you in helping you find your way through this. And I can't recommend these resources highly enough. The first one is a documentary by Deneen Akers and Stephen Eyre called Seventh Gay Adventist. Whether you're a Christian, gay, or an Adventist, none of that matters. It's a documentary about faith on the margins, and I think you'll be I'll tell you this, I was blown away by this documentary. It wasn't what I expected it to be. And the second is a book called Torn, Rescuing the Gospel from the Gay versus Christians Debate by Justin Lee. The third is Love is an Orientation, Elevating the Conversation with the Gay Community by Andrew Marin. And the last one is God and the Gay Christian by Matthew Vines. Actually, this is the last one, Bible, Gender, and Sexuality by James V. Bronson. Again, thank you, each one of you, for taking your time to listen to this week. I'm praying that there are those out there that this is inspired to take a risk to stand with those that you see being scapegoated by Christians or some system. It doesn't have to be Christians. It could be political or economic as well. But whatever it is, keep living in love. Keep loving like Christ. Keep enlarging the kingdom till the only world that remains is a world where love reigns. I love you guys. I'll see you next week.